What's up, what's up? It's your boy Cam Meekins. It's the Cam Meekins Show. Episode number 29. I'm back on track with the number of the episodes. I was kind of off for a couple days. I messed that up, but I'm in here with my guy Matt from We Rate Dogs, founder of We Rate Dogs, author, entrepreneur, just a badass kid, man. What's going on, dude?
Not much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course, man. Cool. Now, I'm really excited to do this episode with you because I love the story of like a young kid who created something from scratch and turned it into like a viable like career.
It's wild. I still have to just
pinch yourself a little.
Pinch myself a little bit that this is what I do.
Yeah.
It was just because it didn't start out. Like, that wasn't the goal starting out at all.
How did it start out?
Yeah. So I was just on Twitter using it as a creative outlet instead of telling my friends, who were my only followers at the time, like what I had for breakfast. I tried to write jokes. And initially it was like, my friends were like, why are you trying to do that? Like, that's not what this platform is for. Like, it really is for just talking shit. And I was pretty late to joining Twitter. Like, all my peers had Twitter before I did. This was probably late 2014. I was just really off social media. So when I first got on Twitter, I was like, I like comedy. I'm going to try to write jokes. And I found a community of people that were trying to do the same thing. That were making jokes for their few followers. And I inserted myself into that community. And the way you grow in that community was, there were a few bigger creators that would like do little contests, like send me your best jokes of the week, and they would retweet their favorites. And so you just slowly grow followers. I just remember the first couple of followers I got that weren't my friends, people I knew in real life. And that was really cool. It was very validating to have a joke hit amongst people I didn't know. So I kind of got addicted to that challenge. At the time, it was 140 characters, so it was very creatively taxing to fit a whole joke and punchline into that space. That's kind of how my social media presence started. I kind of got better at writing jokes. I did a whole animals on dates series of jokes where it'd be little punchlines, but like the concept was that it was an animal on a date, and those jokes did really well. Other jokes that like involved dogs did really well. When I would post my own dogs, people would really like that. So I knew that there was an avenue for a bigger project within that space, essentially.
So were you at this time doing it under a different alias, or was this like We Rate Dogs at this point? You were just trying
this
to be on a
Matt.
Comedy.
Yeah, yeah. I was not like anonymous online. I was Matt_Nelson. There's a lot of Matt Nelsons out there.
Yeah.
I didn't know what my goal was. I enjoyed writing. I was getting super into comedy outside of my own work. I loved John Mulaney specials. I would do my research on their careers, and I kind of thought that I wanted to be not a TV writer, but I had writing aspirations that were comedic. I guess that's what motivated me at the beginning, and then I quickly realized that everyone on the internet loves dogs as much as I do. So I actually went to school for professional golf management, which is a real major. I went to Campbell University in North Carolina.
Professional golf management. Is that management of golf courses, essentially? It's like the business behind it? Or
It's kind of that, but it's anything in the golf industry that you want to do. Golf course design to instruction to just being a head pro. This program kind of set you up for anything.
Do a lot of schools offer this program, or is this
20 in the country? So it's very small, but it actually Campbell had a pretty great alumni program. Mm. So we got to intern at some pretty cool places. I got a lot of exposure to the industry, but nothing I would work at a golf course and I would be picking balls in the range machine, just tweeting. It was very clear that this was my job to help support what I actually wanted to do.
Right.
And I also quickly realized that I would much rather be the member at the course than the glorified cart boy.
Yeah. Well, shit. Yeah.
So, my first semester at Campbell, I was like, the workload wasn't what I thought it was going to be. Like, I was bored. So I was like, oh, okay, I know people love dogs. I have the free time to make a new thing. I actually put out a poll on Twitter. This is like when the poll feature was very new on Twitter. And I was like, hey, should I make a dog rating Twitter account? Like, the rating aspect wasn't like a eureka moment. It was like, I know that consistent, like, if it's going to be a project that has any legs, it needs some sort of consistent aspect to it. So if just putting captions over images, that's been done forever, like, what, how do I make this fresh and give it like some longevity? And the rate, like, rating the dogs, like, oh, that might work. So the poll was like overwhelmingly optimistic about doing this. So I made it. I had about 10,000 followers, which I was very proud of, like, just writing jokes with no, like, no growth hacks or anything, just writing jokes for a couple years. I got to 10,000 followers, and I passed myself in followers in 4 days with the new account. And I was like, why did I just put so much effort in? Like, this is so easy.
So you built up 10K, like, writing jokes on your personal thing. And yes, in 4 days, you got 10K on the dog account.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you figured out the formula, I guess.
Well, yeah. So it was quickly like, I remember the first time, like, I also became, because Twitter is so, like, you immediately know if your joke hit or missed. When you have enough followers that, like, anytime you tweet, some people are online to see it, you know immediately whether you succeeded or not. And since all my content before that was, like, not risky comedy, but I didn't have much confidence in how funny it was before it went out there, it, like, I got really addicted to, like, oh, this, like, that immediate gratification. So I remember, and I would dive into the analytics of it. So I remember when the first dog rates tweet hit like 100 likes in 3 minutes on Twitter. And I was like, I've never done that before. That's very cool. So that helped me kind of craft what people liked and what people enjoyed about the account. And I just ran with what they were telling me they liked. So the best example of that is that the ratings actually started below 10 out of 10, which is like controversial to say now. Like, the first dog we ever posted
that's surprising.
Was an 8 out of 10, because I was like, this is gonna be legitimate dog ratings. Like,
I was really gonna rate them,
and nobody could, like, obviously the concept wasn't a thing yet, so nobody was like, all these dogs are above, like, that didn't exist. Like,
was anybody rating anything at this point? I mean, this might be a controversial question, but
there had to be. Yeah, of course. Like, I think there.
But, like,
was,
obviously, you started a clear trend here with what you.
Yeah, but
doing.
even like essentially. Like, The Social Network, like Hot or Not, like, is the beginning of that movie with.
Yeah, right.
So the idea of comparisons and rate, like, that was definitely a thing. To do it in this format was like what Twitter was waiting for. And that's clear by how quickly the account blew up.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was like, these are gonna be legitimate ratings. This is an 8 out of 10. And then within the week, I did the first 10 out of 10. And then I did my first 11 out of 10, and people went crazy. They were like, this is how it, like, all the dogs are better than perfect, essentially. And right. That's what my account solidified.
Yeah, man, that's so funny that, like, so quickly you were surpassing what you were initially starting on Twitter. And then, like, people just, I mean, is it just because it's just positive content that people love?
Well, what's crazy is that the account has been through definitely an arc in the type of, or like the genre of the content. Like, at the beginning, it was very absurdist humor. Like, I took the joke writing and creativity skill set that I learned from just writing jokes about anything, and I tried to apply it to the dog rates. So I would make up like a name for the dog. I would make up a breed name. I would like combine like a type of wine and a type of cheese and say that's the breed of the dog. Like, I would just make it up. Like, I can't even think of one now, but I would do like this is a Benaboop Cumberbatch. Like, I would combine a bunch of stuff, and like, people knew that it was fake, but it's such a like, an absurdist way of doing that. And people really enjoyed it. Like, that was what grew the account at first. I would rate a chicken, like, and call it a dog and give it like a 2 out of 10 and say like, lays eggs. That's kind of weird. Like, that's how the account was.
Yeah.
And that's what people really enjoyed. That's what got it its first 100,000 followers. Then it became apparent that like mid 2016, the internet needed some sort of wholesome, like, the internet became a cesspool for a little bit. And, I mean, it still kind of is, but the transition from trying to make every dog rate, like, the transition from every dog rate making you laugh to making you smile was mm-hmm. very easy. Like all like the pressure of trying to make you laugh is much higher than trying to make you smile. Like with dog content, at least, we just ended up leaning on the media more. Like once we became a super established account, we were getting 10,000 DMs a day of submissions. And so we were able to pick the very best photos and videos, and my job's done. Like if the photo or video is so good that I just need to get out of the way of it with my caption. Mm-hmm. It can be a little bit boring. It still needs like the perfect cadence and the tone, but if it's over an already fantastic piece of media, then I just have to get out of the way of it.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. So did you end up dropping out of college because of all this?
I did. So I stayed in college for 2 years. So I dropped out after my sophomore year. I went to a second internship, and then in the middle of that internship, I quit it. I quit that job and dropped out of school. Took me way too long in retrospect.
Yeah. Man, do you feel like there was a sense of responsibility once you, because you talked about kind of the shift in the internet that happened around 2016. I mean, I'm curious what you think about that, because I'm sure you kind of were on the front lines. Why do you think that shift has happened? Is it just the cyclical aspect of social media just getting crazier and crazier and more part of our lives?
Yes.
So it's just gone in this negative direction, kind of like the Social Dilemma documentary kind of talks about. It's like this stuff just over time is just so a part of our life that it's actually dictating our life more than we know.
Of course. Yeah.
And it's just all becoming a little negative. So did you feel like a sense of responsibility once you, because, you know, 9 million followers, that's, you know, that's a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so you can really make a difference with spreading a positive message in a world of just hectic bullshit, right?
Yeah, so I'm sure we'll get into a little bit of that responsibility, but I didn't feel that pressure at that time. So it was really like, because Twitter is the news platform, and it always will be, like breaking news occurs on Twitter. It then carries to Instagram and is dispersed from there. But Twitter is where people come to talk about what they just saw happen, or like, and so during the Trump presidency, it was like, it was just chaos, like all the time. If you're a reporter, you exist on Twitter. If you're a journalist, you exist on Twitter. And so it really became like these people were flocking to my account as a respite from the nonsense. Like this is the utopia that exists within the chaos. So it was like, and that was being like through quote tweets and comments on the stuff, like that's what the message of We Rate Dogs was, is like, oh, you can come here and smile and it's different from the rest of the internet. Or like at least it was the most visible at that time. So that's when, like, we were gaining 10,000 followers a day on Twitter at that time. It was nuts. Twitter was, like, if you joined Twitter, we were a suggested follow. We were on their in the app store. We were on the one of the example tweets.
Well, I'm sure they love you because you're a perfect example of the positive aspect of Twitter.
Exactly. Like, if they want to claim that they are not a place where harassment is primarily its
right.
use, like, I'm the poster child for that. But yeah, so the responsibility to, it was in 2016 as well that we got hit with a feeling of responsibility, because people were reaching out to us to help their dog. Like their dog needed treatment or surgery, and they knew we had an audience of people that would probably help fund that. So the first GoFundMe that we ever posted was for a really old pug that needed a wheelchair. And we had featured this pug and its family a few times previously, because it was three pugs and a yellow lab, and they dressed up for every holiday. So like they sent us a Christmas photo, an Easter photo, a Thanksgiving photo, like they sent us everything, 4th of July, everything. And because I had featured them in the past, I was like, okay, my audience is going to, they're going to respond when this dog needs help, because they might feel like they know this dog. I can reference the past posts. I think we can raise this money. And it was like $700, and we raised it in 45 minutes. And that was when it clicked, like, okay, I do have a responsibility here because I'm sitting on so much power that can be used for good. And so after that, we started doing a few more of those. I think we did probably 10 in 2016, and just testing the waters of how much we could raise, what types of situations would resonate with the audience. And it was everything. People were waiting for an opportunity to help. And this was the way that worked, because I would take the traditional dog rate style, and all I would do is put a link at the end of it to the GoFundMe. I would say, right, this is so-and-so. Like, I would explain the situation. I would do a little deep dive into, like, why they need help and what happened. But it kept the format. And with the first Friday of 2017, we posted a GoFundMe every single week, and we've done that since then. And that consistency,
oh, wow,
that consistency has allowed those to be super, super successful. And now it's like a pillar of the account.
So how much money have you guys raised in this way?
$1.6 million.
Wow, man.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's incredible.
It's wild. And every week, so what's way more impressive than the total amount is that we can do it so quickly. Like, today is Friday, and we posted a dog that was hit by a car, had to be surrendered to a shelter because the owners could not afford the treatment, which is a devastating part of the ecosystem that I'm just now learning about. But they needed $15,000, this rescue that brought the dog in. And we were able to raise that in 27 minutes this morning, which is just incredible. Like, I don't know how I've cultivated a community that is so empathetic towards this type of situation, but they are like, GoFundMe is so gamified already. Like, you can watch the ticker go to the goal, but then I also further gamify it, and I edit the caption on Instagram to say fully funded in so and so minutes. So now every comment before that is like, come on guys, like, we got to get it, we're waiting for that update. And so that's super cool. But now we've been able to expand that to, like, once that first dog is funded, we edit the caption to also say the link is now changed to this other dog that needs help. And we're able to fund those second dogs within the day as well. And so that's the part of the arc that we're on right now, is we went from absurdist humor to, like, wholesome, try to make you smile. And that's still our content, but we've really put effort into kind of the philanthropic angle of what you can do with dogs. Like, we've also done some shelter specific stuff as well. And it's just really cool to see people, like, to have the intention of the account not start out that way, but then be very effective in doing these other things has been really cool to see.
Yeah. Have you always been someone who's interested in philanthropy, or, you know, you kind of not stumbled into it, but, like, once you saw how powerful the platform was for something like this, you said, I'm going to go all in on this. I mean, is that, like, the core part of your business now at that point? Like, or
I mean, it's close, because yeah, we have one of our biggest long-term partnership is with Trupanion, which is a pet insurance company, and mm-hmm, that plays a, like, if you have pet insurance, you're not going to end up on our massive list of GoFundMes to post. So that decision making,
right?
So yeah, so I guess it's become more and more of a part of our mission. What was I gonna say?
Well, I was just asking about, like, your interest in philanthropy,
yeah,
and
yeah,
stuff like that.
So I really did stumble into it. I also didn't understand the need. I have never really, so I always had family dogs. I have a German Shepherd now named Doug that has thankfully not needed any massive medical care. But I had no idea of how expensive medical care is for, like, it's just like humans. Once I was made aware of this problem and that I had an easy way to help, it was an easy decision. So again, I made We Rate Dogs to make people laugh. It's a very cool side effect that we're able to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the expenses for, like, I was talking to somebody who was, somebody told me that another friend that they had a Frenchie, and I know that there's a lot of issues with Frenchies and stuff like that. And they're like one of these bred dogs. And mm-hmm, I imagine that you're certainly a person who's, like, very a proponent of adopting dogs, and I'd love to talk to you about that. But mm-hmm, anyways, they said that they had to spend, like, $40,000 in a year on medical expenses.
I believe it, though.
For, like, this dog, yeah. Because mm-hmm, they have a whole host of health problems and things like that.
The super common one is a CCL tear, which is the equivalent of an ACL. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, I don't know. I might be blowing it out of proportion just because we sort through hundreds of GoFundMes every week, but that is the one I see the most. And it's like, all that is running too fast at the park. Like, that's going to happen. And that's like a minimum of a $4,500 spend at the vet to fix that.
And these people who offer insurance for these things, like, does it cover like a comprehensive amount of things for these pets?
So the biggest thing with pet insurance is that it will not cover pre-existing conditions. So you cannot...
they don't have any pet Obamacare.
Exactly, exactly. So you can't have an injured dog and try to get insurance and have it covered. So that's what our awareness campaigns for Trupanion are like, get it before you need it, guys. Like, unfortunately, pet insurance, pet medical care has not progressed and probably will not progress to the point of humans for a very, very long time. Just get it before you need it. So yeah, it's unbelievable. Some of the bills that we see. But yeah, it's also very, like, the Trupanion partnership allows us to fund another dog ourselves Friday afternoons that we just say, it's our way of saying, please get pet insurance. Like, we don't, like, we've got this one, but get pet insurance so you don't end up on
it. That's really cool. I mean, the two things just go hand in hand. And I mean, even just giving the awareness of what insurance can do too is such a positive thing as well, man. Like, that's something that I realize in my life after getting my car stolen last year. Is like, you know, like, I used to not really be someone who really thought too much about the type of insurance that I had.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's renter's insurance or my car or like whatever. But man, like, you don't care about insurance until you need it.
Oh, exactly.
And then you realize that you want the best kind, you know?
Yeah.
So backing up, were you a person who just really loved dogs, or was this something that, like, you know, you just kind of saw an opportunity with? Like, have you grown up with dogs, loving dogs, like, more than the average person? Or
probably not more than the average person, but I definitely did. I've always had golden retrievers. Mm-hmm. There's never, like, I don't think we ever went a month without a golden retriever in the house. And then, like, seeing this, like, bonding with internet strangers over that love of dogs helped me write for the accounts. Like, we have a second account that's Thoughts of Dog, where I literally write as if I'm a dog.
I
couldn't do that account. There are many ways to do, like, you can do that account in a very cheesy way. Like, I'm aware that that account really tight ropes profound and cheesy. And without the years of being kind of inserted into the online dog community, that account would be trash. I think that the only reason I can do that is because, I've been, like, ingrained into that
well, and it's such a community too. There's just so many people, and my mom is really into cats.
Oh yeah, well, that's another thing, is that I know that I didn't just stumble into it because I know I'd be bad at doing it for cats. Like,
oh,
I,
there you go. Yeah.
Like, everyone's like, when's the We Rate Cats coming? And I'm like, it's not.
Not for me.
Like, there's, I think there's like 50 of those accounts, but none of them have really taken off. But it's like, I don't have the same passion. And I think that cat lovers would be like, this would notice that. Like, it would so much of me is in the accounts that you could poke holes in that if I wasn't super interested in writing for a different account.
No, that's true, man. I mean, I do feel like your personality kind of crosses over into like what you're doing, which is what makes it so authentic and so relatable too in a lot of ways.
It would be very hard to, like, I mean, just because, like, I know because of like past controversies, it's very hard for me to separate myself from the account. Like,
yeah,
it is, it's different because obviously it's a dog profile picture and all that, but like, it is very much me. And I learned kind of the hard way that, like, I should not hide behind it like that. Like, I think that people like to know that the person on the other side is a decent person, regardless of how they're consuming the entertainment. I think that's something
kind of start to think about that. Was it a specific instance of something that happened that made you think about that? Or did you just over time think, like, I need to kind of put myself out there too, hand in hand with this?
Yeah, it was like, so I was never like, I never hid behind it. Like, I always had that personal account
right,
to like showcase all the best behind the scenes stuff, like to talk more of not the business aspect of things, but like share some of the cooler things that happened, but that wouldn't necessarily resonate from the bigger account. So I always had that personal account, and it was really like, so I had them going at the same time, and I think that It was the very first Women's March, which I believe was January of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sent a photo of a dog that had a rainbow sign that said, "I march for my moms." And it was, the dog was adorable. The whole picture was adorable. And we posted it and just said, like, "Here's a super supportive pup," like at the, I think it was the Toronto Women's March. And we like accidentally became part of the resistance at that time. Like because of that post went so viral. But also in the replies, someone was like, "I'm sick of seeing like everything about this," just like your classic like right wing person. And so I said, "This isn't something you should be ignoring." And someone else said 100% unfollowed. And I said 100% don't give a shit. That was screenshot because it's coming from a dog.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that coming from the dog account?
Yes, it was coming from the dog account. So someone screenshotted that, and that went just as viral. I think it was like really fun when Dog Rage put someone in a body bag or something, and that went viral just alongside the original post.
Yeah.
And so it made me realize that like that lot, like that people want to know that like I'm someone that supports those things. And it became like that there was an era where like, I mean, it was the whole, like with LeBron, there was like that shut up and dribble controversy.
Yeah.
It's the same shit. Like people don't want to think that their favorite things are against them, I guess. And so to make those few posts that were just me, not even like I knew that they would stir up something, but it wasn't like, I didn't give it a second thought. To get so much support on those was the defining, like, okay, you can be yourself. And if that authenticity shines through, like you're going to be fine.
Well, and it's also like actually probably super advantageous to the overall like strength of what you're doing to actually have a real person connected to it too. That's an authentic, genuine, good person. Because I mean, in the first iterations of social media, things were a little bit more simple, but mm-hmm. now you don't know the intention of an account at the end of the day. It could be like some, you know, Russian, you know, like intelligence operation to like, you know, create like, you know,
and it helps
disconnect in this country or like.
Yeah. And it helps build the community. For
right.
Sure. Like, and it would be very undog-like, I guess, for me not to stand for some of those things. Like, it's very easy for me to go from like dogs are like the embodiment of unconditional love. It makes sense for the account to showcase that in our current political scene as well. So it was like, again, wasn't intentional at the beginning. And then seeing the support was like, okay, like this is something I could feel comfortable speaking out on. So like even last summer we changed one of those Friday fundraisers to the Minnesota Freedom Fund for protesters, for bail for protesters. And because we had a long history of doing things like that wasn't met with overwhelming negativity, like if SportsCenter posts something about it, you know, and you're just, it's fun to go to the comments because they're just they're trash. We had built up, thankfully, like a very empathetic community that wasn't jarring for them. They were like, this makes sense. Even coming from, like, it's so weird for that to came from a dog rating Twitter account, but it made sense because of our history of doing things like that.
Well, and it sucks that it has to be that way.
Very much.
You know, that people, like, you have to specifically show that, like, hey, like, I'm a person who, you know, believes in some of these progressive things that are really just, like, the right thing. It's like, it shouldn't be a debate. But, you know, it's like, you either have to be neutral or you have to be right or you have to be left.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, like, stray away from that or, you know, not show that and then try and speak out on something because you're just going to get met with so much just negativity and hate.
Yeah, and I definitely agree with that. I think most people, even progressive people, would agree that it's not super healthy to expect that from your favorite people. Like, you shouldn't be waiting to figure out what your favorite people think about everything. That is so unhealthy. And unfortunately, there was, and I think maybe we're getting out of it, but definitely last summer where it's like, did you post the black square yet? And it's like, that shouldn't be how we define characters. Like, but unfortunately, like I don't know. It had to be, I don't know. It was a very interesting time. And I think that expecting things like that from creators is definitely not healthy. But it's also, I mean, when appropriate, it's very reassuring to just know, to feel like they are on your side
yeah.
at the same time.
Yeah.
So it's a very weird gray area.
No, it is. And there's so much complexity too, because then there's like the algorithmic aspect of it too, which is just driving the divide even further. Because if you feel one type of way, or even if you just have an inclination to feel a little bit progressive or a little bit conservative or whatever it is, all of a sudden you're getting fed this type of content that actually progresses your ideology even more to the extreme than you maybe would have in your normal just kind of everyday life without that.
Absolutely.
Everybody
on social media at this point has an echo chamber experience.
Right.
Nobody goes there. Nobody logs into any social media app that they've been using for a little bit to find diverse ideas.
Yeah.
Or debate or discussion
of a reasonable level. There's none of that.
You have to go out of your way to follow specific people that have different viewpoints if you want that, because you're not going to get fed it organically at all. So we could talk forever about how the platforms are leading this the destruction of creativity in general, but then also that divide.
Yeah, but it's good too, you know, to have like organic accounts out there doing real things like what you're doing to counteract that, because everything is just a give and take, right? Mm-hmm. And like, yes, the business aspect of these platforms and the algorithmic aspect of these platforms are driving us in a direction, but I do think you're right. There's been a pushback to that, and there's been people understanding the consequences of that, seeing what happened over the last 4 years and with Trump and just how everything was so crazy, regardless of if mm-hmm. you like, you know, thought the guy was good or you thought the guy was bad. You can't deny that it was a fucked up time. You know what I'm saying? And there was just crazy shit going on.
You were forced to pay attention to things that human brains are not designed to pay attention
to
all the time.
And now that I think we've gotten a little bit out of that, there's still a lot of crazy shit going on, but it just, you don't feel like at any moment shit could just fucking collapse.
Yes, and I like, that's something that until you think about it, you don't appreciate it. Because you're still like, at least I am still overwhelmed by, I'm sensory overload 24/7. But if I acknowledge that at least I'm not wondering like if World War III is about to happen, it's a little calming.
Yeah.
So.
And even with like Twitter specifically too, him not being on Twitter has kind of changed the dynamic of Twitter too,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of taken some of that hecticness and that craziness away. And it gives the people who are like ready to pounce at any little thing once he tweeted something or someone else tweeted something against him, it gives them kind of less motivation to like get up and do what they do.
The grifters. Yeah. The grifters that are like that made their followings off of responding to Trump tweets.
Yeah.
So glad that's done.
Yeah. I saw some stat or something like, it was like something about how like once they deplatformed Trump, like a lot of the like ultra right wing chatter kind of just dropped off of Twitter,
which is like, we knew that would happen.
Yeah.
All Twitter had to do was a little bit earlier. Like,
yeah.
I think there would have been, that would have been such a, like, in retrospect, it was the obvious move. Like, now you can see how that chatter dropped down. Like, it would have if they did that earlier as well. It's giving him the microphone that I think, but yeah, that's not shocking. It's just like a bit cowardly for them to do it after it didn't really matter anymore.
Yeah, it's a crazy situation that you even are in a position where you have to think, do we have to take the president of the United States access to Twitter away?
Yeah,
you know, it was a shame that we were in that place. So I imagine if I was like Jack Dorsey, like that's a really hard thing to think through, because the circumstance is just so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But we really were at that point.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think you're right. I think there probably could have been less damage done if it was done earlier mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. I'm curious, like now with all that context, do you feel that responsibility even more now that you're kind of one of these safe havens on social media for positivity and, you know, just like more, just positive stuff?
I think it's changed slightly in that people aren't desperate for that anymore because I hate to credit everything to the rise of TikTok, but I think that everyone is a performer now. And so it's less about, at least for new people that will be joining these platforms, like on Twitter, nobody is logged into Twitter for over a month that hasn't heard of We Write Dogs. Like the whole platform is so stagnant that like, we've captured everyone we're going to capture on that platform. But new people joining social media are looking to do so to perform, not to necessarily consume.
Mm.
And I think TikTok has put the power in everybody's hands to just make anything. And you could go, like, because TikTok does not prioritize following, it prioritizes good content. You can have zero followers, make something great, put it out there, and have a career. Like, it's and that, and everyone knows that. So it's more about how can I make something than it is about being strategic about what you consume, I think. So it feels like a less of a priority on, like, my thinking of what, not what I create in general, but I'm definitely not, like, I don't know. It's hard for me to get in the mindset of, like, oh, I exist to make this group of people smile. It's more so like, I know that they're it's a mix of, like, I know that the generation beneath me is prioritizing making things, not consuming things. So it's less of a pressure, and we just really exist now to maintain that following we built, and also try to, like, I think the bigger responsibility now is to figure out the bigger problems within the dog world of, like, adopt, don't shop and crazy medical bills. Like, that feels like the calling now because of how we're positioned. I think any new creative endeavors have to be slightly different, or a new platform or something like that. Just because, I mean, we would have to do some wild shit to grow on Twitter right now. So I think it's very appealing. Like, for TikTok, we've posted like 10 videos. One of them got 32 million views. So we have 500,000 followers over there. And it's like,
off of basically just the one video doing
well. It got 6 million likes. I have never seen 6 million likes. Like,
yeah, that's crazy.
We've been on Twitter for so long, and at the top of Twitter for so long, and the most we've ever gotten is like 700,000 likes. And to just accidentally, like, it was a UGC video that we put. It was a good caption, but no one cares about the caption on TikTok. So it was all in the video and the audio chosen. I just never, like, that speaks to the absurd amount of people that are over there. And
yeah, because what's the most retweeted tweet? Isn't it only like a couple million, or like a million five?
Oh, yeah,
or something.
I really
like that? Wasn't
know.
It some,
I
like,
really
fucking selfie
this.
At the Oscars or something?
It was
shit.
That, and then it was the Nugs for Card chicken nuggets guy with Wendy's.
Oh yeah,
guy passed him, I think. But, like, even that does not, like, pales in comparison to the numbers that we're seeing on TikTok.
Well,
like,
that, yeah, it's fascinating. Like, yeah. 6 million likes, and that happens a lot. Like, I mean, obviously it's a great feat, but I'm saying, like, that, you know,
every day.
You're not the only video with 6 million likes.
No, and some of those videos are coming from people that had no audience before that. So that is so attractive to a whole generation that society is demanding that they perform. Like, of course they're gonna flock to the platform that lets them do that on a scale they never thought possible. Like, something that was so appealing to me with Dog Rates at the very beginning was, like, oh my God, I can reach people. Like, there's the cool factor that celebrities are on Twitter and they can just comment on a post and it's so normal. Like there's no, the barrier to your favorite people is non-existent on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very cool to me to see, like, oh my God, I just made a tweet and Cole Sprouse followed me because of it, and he retweeted it, and now, like, all these other people, like, that concept was so wild to me at the beginning. Now it's the norm. Like, anybody can make anything and have it exposed to the world. And I think that there are downsides to that, but from a young creator's perspective, oh my goodness, like, the people I see thriving on TikTok are brilliant. And I think that as someone that was popular in 2016, like, I want that, but I'm also self-aware to the point that, like, I know what it would take for us to achieve that level of thriving, I guess.
No, I completely hear what you're saying, because you're talking to somebody who got popular on you know, social media in 2011, which is a whole nother generation of, like, kind of the type of content and the way, you know, and, like, in those days, it was straight feed. Right?
It's chronological.
Yeah,
no,
chronological. So, like, I could tweet something and it would actually get shown to the people that were following me that were online at that moment, not whether or not it was good or bad or whatever. And, you know, so in my head, I'm still thinking of social media in that way, because that's when I was, like, the young kid on the come up trying to figure it out, whatever.
And it's so frustrating now to, like, to know that you made a good thing and to happen to put it out at the wrong time or while something else is trending and have it not be appreciated at the same scale that it could have been. That's obviously very, very frustrating. And you see whole companies being built on that premise. Like
right.
Community, the texting platform, is all about like, we break through the algorithm
right.
like until you need to make money and then you won't anymore. It's just interesting how it's changed. And yeah, to fight with algorithms. And I know like I definitely have less of a leg to stand on complaining about it because of the type of content that I'm making. Like, again, 50% of my job is done based on finding the right media that's being submitted to us. Mm-hmm. I get very self-conscious about complaining about certain things because while I think we're delivering value, it's less so than someone that made 100% of the thing that they're putting out.
Sure.
I didn't take that photo. I didn't take that video. I am curating them and attaching words to it, but I'm careful about complaining
about
certain
different things, you know, and like, but I think it's clear now that at this point, like, that's something that is needed in the social media kind of ecosystem, right? Mm-hmm. Like the aggregated content, you know, is like one of the most important parts of like this whole ecosystem, right? And I think there was maybe a time where people were like, fuck, Jerry is whack.
Oh, because, well, okay, you know, well, like, I was part of that group because, so I, that 20, that Twitter, weird Twitter joke writing of 2014, 2015, that was the content. My friends and I's content were appearing on those accounts uncredited.
Yeah.
And this was a time where it was everyone knew that if you were talented enough in the writing space, you got a late night TV job. And to just have that ripped and monetized by aggregators was very, very frustrating. And like, because I was someone that happened to and saw it happen to my friends, like when I made We Rate Dogs, it was like, okay, this is going to be user submissions only. And photo tagging exists. Like,
totally.
Attribution is very easy on the platforms now. And it was when I made the account. So I like literally I... When I made the account, I was like, do you remember Common White Girl and the Dory account and all those on Twitter?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the parody accounts all ran by one person. Like, I knew that I wanted to be everything those accounts were not. Like, I wanted to build a community around content that was original, even though I was attaching it to media. It was original, and I was featuring something that you've never seen before because it was sent to us only. So it was very intentional, like, how that community was built at the beginning, because I just didn't want to be those other accounts. And now, thankfully, I think there was a movement that was after I started We Rate Dogs. It was probably 2016, 2017, where now all those accounts credit. They attribute correctly.
And it was because of that pushback. No, that's a really good perspective, because I didn't think about that. But that makes a lot of sense, that like a lot of these, you know, kids who are writing this stuff are doing it as a way to kind of build a resume,
of
right?
course.
Or and a portfolio.
Then, and then you see it uncredited
right.
to 5 million people.
Right.
And you're like, it's so much more of a what if. Like, if you credited me appropriately, where could I have 10,000 more followers, and could one of them be a scout for a late night? Like, it's very much that opportunity is gone because you decided to crop my username out of it. So yeah, I think that helped shape We Rate Dogs for sure. And very happy that that's kind of shifted. You still have aggregator accounts, and I agree that they can be used for good. I think that, what is it? Quentin Quarantino account raised like $1 million when who died? Who it was a right winger who died. Oh, Limbaugh.
Oh yeah.
Died.
Yeah.
And he raised money for Planned Parenthood or something, like in honor of his death. It was very funny, and it worked.
That's pretty funny.
And I think that those parody accounts, once they, like, there's good and the bad, and I think that crediting appropriately, attribution, and then not directly monetizing those other stuff, like, I think it's still Fuck Jerry that like compiles the tweets and then it's an ad for his liquor or something.
Yeah.
So like that type of stuff you can complain about, but I think it's definitely come a long way. And as someone that's tiptoed into that space, it's just being aware of like what your community is telling you. If your comments are full of credit this person, like, you're doing something wrong. But if you're fortifying a community with the content, then you're good.
Well, and it's just part of that thing. Whenever there's like a new Wild West kind of situation, there's no regulation, there's no rules. And that's what social media was for the last 10 years. And in a lot of ways still is, even though it's changing and becoming more corporately influenced, and certainly there's a lot more government interest on it now and things like that. But it has been, from a, you know, economic business standpoint, the Wild West. And so people like a Fuck Jerry could come out and do whatever they want, take a bunch of content, aggregate it, monetize it, and just ask for forgiveness later. And that's how people have always made money in the history of life. I love history and reading about shit like this. And I read this book that talked about how, like, if you, you know, like 90% of the money that's been made in life has come from times where there wasn't enough regulation on the system so people could exploit it for greed and all these things.
Doesn't have a tap on it yet.
Right. Like the robber baron age, where you could just completely shut down a whole other person's business by, you know, just sheer kind of ruthlessness and force and having a monopoly because there was no regulation and you didn't have to pay your workers any good wage and you could make them work for 20 hours a day. And
yeah, I guess the modern, like the more modern equivalent is like when, like the I don't know who was first, was Postmates first? Whatever that, like now there's, but there's 10 of them.
I think it might have been DoorDash.
DoorDash, whichever one was first obviously had like a glory period of like, oh, you're the new thing. So like, and then you have competition. Like once there's competition, that feels like the new age regulation, and then it comes. Then then governments get involved and whatever. But yeah, if you've got a new like that, like if you've got a new thing, like you and it has enough legs to like that you spawn competitors. Like you know you're in the glory age of that thing.
Totally, totally. And it just boils down to, too, like, are you going to be a genuine, authentic person, or are you just going to be an asshole? You know, and you can kind of go both ways with it, and you can take a system that's unregulated and, you know, basically abuse it to your own benefit, or you can still work within that system in a ethical way.
Of course.
There's just not as many people that do that.
Or examples of that. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, again, it kind of, in some ways can benefit though, because when you are out there, you know, kind of operating in this authentic way, it's cyclical in the sense that people appreciate that. So then you get more support, and it's long-term support. It's like me and music, you know, I don't necessarily need to have, you know, the most amount of fans, but if I do right by them and create a good like ecosystem where everyone's getting something out of it, that's a fan that can be with me for life
and there are
the album 10 years from now.
Of course. And there are platforms that I feel like Patreon's a platform that prioritizes that.
Yes.
And I mean, there's a few other ones, but platforms that are kind of here for creators, even if it's under a guise of like, yeah, we're going to take a percentage, but it's still like, we know that creators want to prioritize their followings or have a good relationship with their followings, and here's a bunch of ways to do it.
Yeah.
Like I think we'll see even Twitter's experimenting with some of that stuff. I don't think they'll succeed necessarily with
it. The pay per content model.
It's just like no one on Twitter is there for that. And that's coming from someone who's curated a community that would be there for that.
Right.
We would have to really dive into what that extra content is, what I think are called super followers. Like, what would we be providing them that would justify it on a platform where it's never existed before?
Well, and where you can only offer really, you know, simple video content and written posts. Whereas
exactly.
on Patreon, you can offer to live stream, or you can offer different incentives, or you can give a merch, or you can do all these different things. Like, I started a Patreon recently, and like, I'm trying to figure out that value proposition, because that's the hardest part.
Yeah. What do your fans actually want? Like, what is going to raise the bar for them that has them open up their wallets in a time where, like, I'm not entirely sure what your demographics are, but ours are mainly people without money.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, like, and I know, like, just the general economy right now, it's not a time where you necessarily feel great about like pushing merch, or like we are very, very, like we even, the first week where the pandemic really set in, even for our GoFundMe that Friday, I made a post before it that was like, hey guys, I know the world's crazy right now. We're gonna do one this week, but it's gonna be a much more modest goal. But that announcement made us like literally break GoFundMe with the amount of donations. But
right.
being aware of stuff like that, like, sometimes I'm way too aware of it, but other times it like saves us from maybe misstepping in asking of stuff from our followers.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think platforms like Patreon that do prioritize that relationship and give all those options, those are healthier communities than like than many others.
Well, this is why, like at the beginning of the show, I said like I'm so excited to talk to you, because I could just tell, you know, I'm a entrepreneurial minded person, and I could already tell that you are like that too, in the sense that you really have a level of depth understanding to these platforms and just the whole, you know, interconnected, just social media mm-hmm. dynamic. And so it's just so interesting to hear your perspective on it, because I do think that there's this shift happening. And when you said the whole, you know, TikTok is this new platform where people aren't as much concerned about consuming, even though they are consuming a lot, they're equally as concerned about creating on the platform, and more people are going to TikTok to try and be the creator than they are to be just the consumer.
Just with how friendly the controls are.
Right.
Like, and that's, I think it happened with Snapchat, and it hasn't happened yet with TikTok, where your grandparents got on it.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think that you know you're succeeding with a social media platform when like it's that universal. Like, I mean, all successful social medias end up becoming universal, but to see that happen with something new is very cool.
Well, these are just like these internet basics that we just need in our life, right? And like the first iterations of social media were just like those basic things that we need. Like Twitter is like a digital utility for us now. Like we need that to exist because we need to get information in that way, in that type of form factor, 140 characters, 280 characters, whatever it is, that needs to exist for a purpose now. But to your point, it's not necessarily the place to grow a following now. And Instagram is kind of following along the same lines. Instagram is one that I'm a little bit more unsure of, honestly.
Same?
Like Twitter, I understand why Twitter would need to be here in 10 years. But if TikTok is going to be what it is, I don't know why Instagram would need to be here.
So Instagram also, like, they swallowed, like, so they added stories because Snapchat popped off.
Right.
They added Reels because TikTok popped off. Like, and that is not a sign of a blossoming entity. They can steal because they're so big. And that's got to run out eventually. Like, you're going to eventually make something that does not work with your brand, I guess. And they also, I feel like they're like, because I'm very Twitter-centric, but also I see people complaining about Instagram more. And I'm not sure if that's just because the majority of creators are on Instagram and not Twitter. It probably is. But it's all like they seem to mess with they seem to make more unpopular choices with their platform than other social medias.
Sure. Sure. Well, I think that kind of goes back to our discussion of like doing things in a more authentic way, or doing it out of like greed and, you know, potential megalomaniac tendencies. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
And I do see a lot of similarities between like, Zuckerberg and like a Jeff Bezos type of situation. And I think that Instagram is trying to go in that direction of becoming like a shopping platform, you know?
And why, you know?
Right. Right. Like, and it's just pure greed, mm-hmm. right? It's never been about for Zuckerberg.
Why do something purposeful when we can do everything?
Right.
Like, I think that, and who knows if it'll be its downfall or not. Because when they added stories, that was the one thing that was exclusive to Instagram over Twitter. So we grew like crazy on Instagram because we started using stories, and that allowed, like, that was just a growing period for us because it was something Twitter didn't have. So now I don't even know what our crossover is. Like, I don't know if we have a million followers that follow us in both places or 50,000, you know, because of kind of the nature of both platforms, or like, because it's the same content. We copy and paste over to the other platforms, and the only bonuses you're getting are that story content.
Right.
Because we really haven't like fully adopted like the fleets or whatever it is, Twitter story.
It doesn't seem like that. I mean, I love Twitter, but it doesn't seem like that. It's like catching on.
It's not, because no one views it. Like the first day, like I was so excited. We have 12 million followers on three accounts, and we get to post a story that, if algorithmically is correct, will show to everyone that got on the platform that follows us in those 24 hours. And it did for one day. We got like 450,000 views on our story. And I was like, oh, that's incredible. That's triple what I've ever gotten on Instagram. And I know I have less followers, but stories have been native to Instagram for a long time. And then the next day it was like 80,000. And I was like, okay, so no one's going to use this. And pretty much we've kept periodically putting things up just to see, like, oh, are people getting used to it? Who's using this? And it's some people, but it will never, like, the ratio of people who follow you that watch your story is so drastic compared to Instagram. Like Instagram, that ratio is just much healthier, higher.
Yeah. I even just think like the user interface of it is just a little bit like when I try and like get out of it, it kind of like glitches sometimes.
Twitter wasn't meant for like, yeah. It's so clear what, like, I think for Twitter story to work, like you have to mess with the whole mechanics of the platform.
Right.
And people love Twitter because it's that feed that you get your news from. And I think there's parts of it but it's hard for something that big to like be satisfied.
They're always trying to innovate. Yeah.
Yeah. And at some point you have to, but like people also know what they want. And I feel like maybe they don't until they see it, you know, like TikTok exists because there wasn't something that like Vine had it. But that gap in the market was able to be filled for a reason also. So,
yeah. But I think back to the kind of earlier point about where this is all going and Patreon and, you know, just the whole creator conversation. What I love about the change that's happening and the change that you identified with TikTok is that like people are understanding that you can build a following, whether it's, you know, as large as yours or a more small niche following, you can build a following and find different ways to really directly connect with these people, whether it's using community or Patreon or whatever it is, and create a nice business for yourself where then you can participate in our economy and do something positive for our overall, you know, just our country and our economy. And it seems like we're going in this direction of more of like a service-based, content-based economy for people our age and younger versus go to college, get a job, work for corporate America. Like, you know, there's going to be people always that do that, but there's going to be, you know, 10, 20, 30% more people getting into creating something for themselves and just getting enough people to monetize it, maybe make $75,000 a year or $100,000. Like, great. That's awesome.
I don't know where I saw the statistic, but the number one thing that second graders want to be is a YouTuber.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Isn't that nuts?
But when I was in second grade, I said I wanted to be an NBA player. So it's like the
modern equivalent. So it might be, yeah. I guess it is.
But it is crazy. No, it's crazy.
Yeah, and then the third was like a dog raider, I think, was the third on that list.
A dog raider?
Dog raider that kids wanted to be, yeah. But yeah, I think that speaks to like how the traditional paths just aren't the only ones, and social media forced everybody to see that. You don't have to go to college.
Right.
There's so many different things you can do with your cell phone now that like as long as you have the privilege of having a device like this and internet access, you can do anything. And I think social media showed everyone that, and now it's very hard for older generations to ignore that it's an option, and mm-hmm. it's a good one for some people.
Yeah. Were you always interested in doing that for yourself? I know that you studied golf management.
Yes. Yeah, so I was a swimmer and a golfer, and I didn't care about anything else.
So you did you get good grades in school?
Yeah, like? I did the bare minimum. Like I was not a straight A student, but close. But I would also put in the minimum amount of effort.
But you're a smart kid; you could get by.
I got by without putting a ton of hours into it. And yeah, I was like swimming or golf, and there's not a career in swimming unless you're an Olympian. And I'm 5'8", so. And then golf is this massive industry that the major that I talked about, it opens the door for anything within that. So it was kind of like, oh, I'll try this. Like, this makes sense for me. I looked at three schools, applied to one, and went there. And then, yeah, I was like, this isn't really what I expected it to be. Let's have fun somewhere else. And that was on Twitter. And I got super lucky. Is my story.
Yeah. And did you have any concern from any like family or anything like that in terms of like, oh, what are you doing? Like,
yeah. So I made the account on November 15th of 2015. And so the next week was like winter break. So I got to come home. And this is when I was posting like 20 times a day. It was like all I wanted to do because it was so fun and fresh and people were enjoying it. And my parents were like, why are you spending so much? Like, I just didn't do that before I left for college. So it was very, like, my parents thought it was a little bit weird. And then I did an interview with New York Magazine in that same winter break. And that made it very real for them.
Yeah.
They're like, how did this happen?
Right.
So that kind of eased their minds about it. Again, I went back to school. Like, I was still focused on school and what I thought I wanted to do. And then it was the next summer, or I guess the following summer of 2016, where we experimented with merch. We did some stickers based off our more popular posts. We also started, like, we posted our first few videos on the account. The account started taking off. This is when we went from 200,000 followers to 5 million over the course of a year. And that just was very validating for the people around me that were like, should we support this or not? Like, in terms of, like, should this be your thing or not?
Yeah.
And so that was very validating. We ended up launching a full merchandise store 9 months after I made the account. And that kind of made it less risky to quit the job and drop out because I had a runway for myself. And of course, owe a lot to my parents for letting me come back. Like, I dropped out, came home for a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
And that is where I kind of, that was my testing ground to see, can I do this full time? And it was very quickly apparent that I could. We got our first partnership, which was with Disney, to promote Lady and the Tramp. Like, they did a Blu-ray version of it, and we got a partnership with that. And once you do a partnership with Disney, the door flies open for any other opportunity in that space. I won like a Shorty Award, which is, I got to go to New York and do an acceptance speech. It was very
That's
cool.
Like the social media awards.
Yeah. Like, they try to make it seem important. It's not too important, but it's also,
it's
very
cool though. Yeah.
It's very cool to be, cause like in no other way can you be recognized for that type of accomplishment.
Yeah, right.
So to, well,
it'll get more and more important, I'm sure.
I think so. Like, they're still around, like, they're in their 13th year or something doing it. So, yeah, I think that they'll continue to at least have higher and higher tune in as the creators that they're bringing in are bigger and bigger and more like a part of people's lives. But so all of those things made it clear that I can do this. And then it was really just waiting to figure out, like, okay, who of my friends are going to help me come to LA, like, and be my roommates. John, who was a part of the business from really early on, like, that story is pretty funny. He offered to buy the account when I had less than 100K.
Did you guys know each other prior to this?
No. He was.
Yeah, so how do you know John and Jacek and them? Did you grow up in New England? Or
No. I grew up in Northern Virginia and then West Virginia.
Got it.
So really a hotbed of social media, West Virginia is.
Shout out Huey Mack.
Yeah. So I knew John. So again, John messaged the account and asked to buy the account. And I saw from his page that he was like one of these was in the market of buying and selling Twitter accounts. Like, he was interested in the social media marketing behind some of these accounts. So immediately that was very interesting to me.
That there was like a business aspect to it.
Yeah. But I was like, absolutely not. This is my baby. Like, go away. And then a few months later, like, I was very overwhelmed by school. I felt like I was letting everyone down by not seeing every DM that came in, which was thousands a day at that time. So I was very overwhelmed and I reached back out to him and I was like, I'm done with it. Like, how much? And he said, no, what do you need help with? And then he started looking through the DMs. So he's seen more dog pictures than anybody else on the planet. And, that was without him saying, like, what do you need help with? If he would have given me a price, we would have found the right price and I wouldn't be sitting here.
Isn't it crazy that there's just things in life like that where if it just went a little bit different, maybe if, like, you freaking drank a little less coffee that day or something like that, your whole entire life would be completely different. You might be fucking managing North Ranch Country Club right now.
Exactly. Yeah. So I owe a lot to John, and his role for, I mean, more than 3 years was curating those DMs, and it grew from a text message of 20 screenshots or so that would crash our phones after a little bit to WeTransfers that stopped working, and then it was Google Drive, and then now we have a fully built out system, and he's not the one going through them anymore.
Yeah.
But that's how I met John. Super instrumental in the beginnings of this, and then he was managing Jerry at the same time.
Yeah, Jay-Zach, shouts out.
So then I convinced, like, Jerry was kind of on the same path of, like, if I want to grow, like, LA is kind of a place where we need to at least try to exist. Like, the collaboration opportunities here are incredible, especially, like, going from virtually no opportunity to talk to anyone in the space in Charleston, West Virginia, to coming out here and everyone being in the space was super welcoming for me, and I'm sure the same for him. So I convinced them to come out here in early 2019 was when we were all kind of ready. We knew it took us a little bit because we knew that we didn't want to be homeless or go back in like 6 months. So I think we were waiting until we were confident in our ability to stay for however long it would take to see if this was the place.
Yeah. And it's just so nice to be around people that understand that you're doing something that, and it makes sense to them. And as totally. Opposed to them looking at it, like, what are you doing? Kind
yeah,
of thing.
And looking at it like it's an oddity. Right. The first big example of that was like, Hozier was doing an album promotion on Twitter, and someone asked him to rate their dog, and he said like 11 out of 10. And so I hopped in and I was like, actually, Hozier, this is a 12 out of 10.
Right.
And that resulted in a DM from Columbia to come to one of his shows.
Right.
That was out here. And then because we got that intro, we ended up shooting a whole video with him where like the bit was that I kind of interviewed him surrounded by shelter dogs, which it turned out to be a super, super well done video. But it got me thinking, like, yeah, if I was still in Charleston, West Virginia, I'm sure that he wouldn't have happened to have a concert there to do that. So, I mean, that's a very obvious example of what can happen out here. But then also, yeah, just feeling more accepted in what I do. Like, still I lie to people when I first meet them and tell them I'm in social media marketing. I'm not like I'm the dog rates guy.
Why do you do that? Because you just don't want to have the conversation, or is there a part of you that's like embarrassed about it, or like imposter syndrome? What is it?
It's totally imposter syndrome, but at the same time, it's like if you know of We Rate Dogs, it's kind of cool. If you don't, it's so weird for me to say that.
Just don't like I don't think that there's a lot of people that don't know about it though.
I don't know because I don't try that.
Yeah, sure.
I don't try that. But it's very much imposter syndrome. I think there was an example recently where I was like, damn, this is like I don't belong here. But that happens a lot out here. Like, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But I don't think it stems from a lack of faith in what I create, how niche it is.
Right.
Like, it's hard to explain to people. Like, there's no elevator pitch for it.
Yeah.
I mean, there kind of is. Like, hey, I rate dogs online. They all get above 10 out of 10 because they're all better than perfect. But you don't get the full, like,
you just hearing that alone, you're not understanding, like, oh, wow, like, this is a really, like, incredible thing. And, like, there's so much complexity to it.
Or that, like, I could just say that and have no followers and just be doing it. Like, I need more context in order for people to appreciate it. And I'm not about to do that, especially if you don't know what it is. I feel, like, I don't know even how I feel, but it's super uncomfortable for me to be like, yeah, this is what I do. Like, if you don't get it at all, it's very hard for me to explain it to you.
Yeah.
So I just don't. I'm like, yeah, social media marketing.
No, I hear you. I hear you. Sometimes I just, if people ask me like what I do, I just say like, oh, I produce music.
Yeah. Some people, because I told that to other people and they're like, just say you work with dogs. That's like so much cooler.
That's true. That's a good answer.
Yeah. So yeah, I work with dogs. What do you do? Oh, I actually run this account. Like, it's an easier transition as well.
Or you could just take it fully left field and just be like, you know, I do something that you just completely random and then just try and go with it and just freestyle.
Yeah. I also don't have the confidence to just lie to people like that.
Yeah.
I wish I did, but I think I'm going to go that route. Just be like, yeah, I work with dogs, and then like, oh, that's so cool. And then I can be like, yeah, I actually run this account, and then it's an easier transition.
Yeah. So I want to get like a couple, you know, just thoughts from you on kind of, I'm assuming now at this point, like you're, you know, somewhat of an expert on kind of what's going on in the animal world in terms of dogs and shelters and all of this stuff. It's a complex problem. And, you know, truthfully, I don't know a lot about it. I understand conceptually that it's probably best to adopt when you can. But beyond that, like what are the issues that are most important right now in this space that, you know, you are taking an interest to, that maybe you guys are trying to kind of do something, you know, with like, what, where's your headspace at on that stuff?
Yeah, so I'll start by saying that, again, these are things that I'm only aware of because our community tells me about them. It's same thing with our content. Like, if they're, like, people send us things they want us to see. So, like, we have, we want to dip our toes into more dog news type of stuff because we can't, it's impossible for us to miss a dog story because we're told about it immediately.
Right.
So again, everything I'm about to talk about is because other people have told me about it. I'm not inherently an expert or studied any of this, this dog world ecosystem. But, I think the thing that you may have seen in the news recently that is probably the most notable problem now is that so many people got pandemic puppies and now they're giving them back, which sucks. Like, hopefully it's nobody in our audience. Like, hopefully our audience has an appreciation for dogs that, like, they know that it's a responsibility and it's not a hobby or a purse. Like, this is a dog and this is a living creature and it's a commitment when you sign those papers. But yeah, unfortunately, so many people got, shelters were making headlines because they didn't have dogs. It was very hard to adopt a dog. Like, and the trend is going with adoptions to have it be, a pretty rigorous, application process. I think you can go to some shelters and just because they are overcrowded, it's less so. But my family, right before I moved out here, my mom was kind of hellbent on adopting a senior golden retriever because she's a big fan of an account called the Golden Ratio, and they are like mega fosters for golden retrievers it seems like they average one new golden retriever a month that they add to their crew, and so my mom is a huge fan of them. I actually know them pretty well, and so she really wanted to adopt a senior golden. We have one other golden that is purebred. But with my account growing and my family starting to understand these issues too, they will never buy another puppy. But the application process, like, we had people come to our home and look around and like verify not only information that we're providing, but like it was an interview process essentially for this dog that desperately needed a home. So as that trend continues, we're going to hopefully see less and less of returns to the shelter. But I would say that, yeah, right now it's unfortunately that a lot of those pandemic puppies were because I'm bored and have time, and now you're going back to work and the puppy's a handful. It's now much bigger than you probably thought it would be and is taking up much more resources. It's also a financial commitment. Like, it's not we obviously prioritize, like, hey, if something bad happens, that's a lot of money, and you don't want that to be the reason you have to give the dog back. Because then you're definitely not getting the dog back. But also, as we treat our pets more like children, we're also going to feed them better food that costs more. We're going to give them better things that cost more. Like, and I think that when people were just like, it's a pandemic, I'm lonely, I'm going to adopt a dog, didn't fully realize that because it was just a convenient thing to do. So hopefully we're at the point where like it starts to come back down. Like, I think hopefully we're over the hump of most of those returns and it isn't much worse than we think. But that's probably the thing right now that is the most plaguing on the ecosystem.
Yeah. Wow. That makes a lot of sense because you're right. A lot of people were adopting and just as like something to do in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But on the other side of that, it's good that there does seem to be a whole lot of understanding now. The consensus is that, like, you know, if you're going to get a new dog, adopting is the way to go. Whereas maybe 5-10 years ago, it wasn't as clear as that.
Yeah, and I think that, but then I think that I'm just sheltered by my own community because sometimes I see TikToks that are literally like the account manager is a breeder and they're just doing the cute trends because they're trying to sell as many puppies as they can. And and they get millions of likes, and that opens my eyes up to like, oh, people who don't follow us, which is a lot of people, aren't in that mindset yet. So hopefully you're right, but I also think that we may not be as far along as like if you took a survey of my audience would lead you to believe.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that's like a lot of these things, man. It's like, you know, there's a lot of talk about it, but when it push comes to shove, if you ended up like making $1 million and all of a sudden like money wasn't an issue, like how many of these people actually would go and buy like the designer dog or do this thing because they think that it's cool or it looks like a certain way.
Yeah, and a lot of people have good intentions when they get to the shelter, and then they don't see an Aussie doodle there, and they're like, oh, well, I tried. And it's like, no, when you're going to a shelter, you have to understand that you're going to bring home a dog in some cases that requires more effort. The funny part is they're going to be healthier than your purebred dog, and you're going to end up spending less money on them because of potential illnesses and whatnot. But yeah, I think people, the gap may be in that they have good intentions, but they then revert back to buying because it's a more comfortable approach. And so actually I'm a new dog dad as of last August. Again, I only grew up with dogs. I never like had a dog that was mine. So when I came out here, I was like dogless for 2 years. I felt like a fraud, running the accounts without a dog. We've also worked with some rescues in this area. So I, follow them on Instagram, and I saw
Wagmore. Is that one of them that's around here?
That's familiar.
I follow one on Instagram that's always got some
Wags
some
great, and Walks, maybe.
Yeah, something like that. Studio City, I think.
Gotcha. Yeah. So we've done work with Deity Animal Rescue. That's actually in Beverly Hills, which is crazy that there's an animal rescue in Beverly Hills. Mm. But they put on Instagram this German Shepherd with a wonky ear behind in a cage, and I texted the owner of the rescue, and I was like, I want him, he's mine. And so we had a brief back and forth. I went to visit him and I took him home the next day, and that was like, I knew I was in the market for a dog for a while, but something about seeing him, I was like, oh, this is an easy decision, I'm ready. And something about adopting a senior dog was very comfortable from an optics perspective. Like it was very aligned with my values, what I wanted the account's values to be. So it made a lot of sense. They think he's 10, or they told me he was 10. I think he's a little bit younger, just because he's in super good health and he can run around. And 10 is a really old German Shepherd.
Do they have any way of truly, like, if you wanted to pay the money to like truly like date a dog?
They have to. I feel like when it's a
carbon dating or something.
I was gonna say it's probably dental records. They can probably track something, but either they did that and determined he was 10, or they did a little guesstimate, and it's not like super, super important. But yeah, and then so an example of it being more than people may realize is that Doug is very dog reactive, and that's something that he became with me because he's just super protective of me. So it's like a black ops mission when we go on walks, and that's not what I signed up for. But it doesn't matter because like this, he's my responsibility. I made this commitment. It doesn't matter what came with that. So we're managing that, but I can fully understand someone who was not ready for that giving him back, because it's a challenge. It's something you have to work on. It's more investment. So I think that while Doug and I's story is a good example to share, I also can't expect everyone to have the resources to do that. So that's a little bit of an interesting dynamic as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I imagine it's complicated, man, because it's probably one of those things too, where it's like as the wealth divide gets a little crazier too. The people that do have money do want to spend money buying these type of more, you know, purebred animals, and then that creates an economy for people who don't have money to actually want to breed these animals and sell them.
Yeah,
and so like, you know, that could get worse in that sense before it gets better if we don't continue to have these conversations and educate people more. And
yeah, you know. And what's crazy when you think about it is that we could potentially not have a shelter animal in a decade or so, because that's the lifespan of dogs. You know, like if we had effective change, this problem can be gone in 2 decades. So I think that, like, the only animal that should be in a shelter is if owners passed away or like ran away, and then it's very easy to find, like, you're not going to be overwhelmed. So those situations are going to be easier to fix. But yeah, it's difficult. I think that accounts like mine and ones that prioritize the bond with all dogs instead of like, oh yeah, if you buy a dog, they're going to love you more. Like, that's just, it's easy to demonstrate how that's false. And I think that, yeah, over time, like many things, many progressive ideals, like the time of adopting a dog might go away.
Yeah. So where's a place that people, you know, obviously your platform is one of them, but where else can people find some information on some of this stuff? Or, you know, if they feel compelled to kind of look into it more, which I'm feeling, where can someone go?
So your local shelters, out of necessity, have gotten really good at Instagram, I bet, because they've recognized that that is how you get attention to your shelter. I would start there. I would find your local shelters. I would find them on social media. They're going to be doing, like, post-COVID, they're going to be doing events where you can meet some of the dogs. Like, that, a good shelter will make their social media presence tell you how you can get a little bit more educated, see if you're in the market for adopting a dog or a cat. So I would say start there. And then, honestly, there's so many resources, because people were lonely during the pandemic, about adopting, that you can find with a simple Google as well, to let you know what, like, that you are ready for that type of commitment. Something that would do a little cost analysis for you so that you're financially prepared. Something to help you determine what breed would vibe with your lifestyle, which is a little bit limiting in the shelter. Like, you're not going to find, how do I put this? Like, if you're an outdoorsy person, yeah, of course you can find, your perfect dog in a shelter. If you just had a baby, you might not be able to, because of the attention that dog is going to need, the exercise that dog is going to need. And potentially if they need to be comfortable around all types of living creatures, if you're going to bring them, like, that does limit the pool of potential adoptions. But yeah, I would say that there's a lot of information out there just because of where we are in this problem. And there's also, a lot of shelters are great at social media because they've seen, how impactful it can be on their adoption rates.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's great info, man. Well, shit, dude. I really appreciate having this conversation, man. This has been awesome, man. We got to do it again.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm down anytime.
Hell yeah. Well, Matt Nelson, my guy, We Rate Dogs. What's the actual Twitter at? It's not We Rate Dogs, right?
It's We Rate Dogs everywhere but Twitter. On Twitter, it's dog_rates.
Got it. Follow him on social media. He needs the help.
Thanks,
my guy. It's the Cam Meekins Show. We out of here. Peace.